May 23rd, 2008, and I'm Will Pratt. I'm interviewing Kenny Jamoko about his childhood experiences in Vancouver, being a Japanese-Canadian and being evacuated from there, as well as his military career. So we can start with your biographical information. What's your full name and your date of birth?
Okay, good afternoon, Will. Good to be talking to you. Facing your face. 53rd century, that's quite different from on the phone,
yeah.
So I'm glad to be doing this with you for your master's.
It's a side project, more independent project. But
good.
I might be writing something or other about it, we'll see.
Yeah, you have an excellent coordinator here and a big chair too, so yeah. It's a pretty good project for you.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, my name, I guess, full name is... Japanese name Kyo, K-Y-O, and Ken, that's my Canadian name. Ujimoto was born in Haney, Maple Ridge, known as right now, just on the outskirts of Vancouver. That was in January 31st of 1937. And that's where my father, Isamu Ujimoto, he's passed away 10 years ago now, up in San Antonio, but that's where he had a family grocery store. And my mother, Takeko Ujimoto, and I guess my brother Victor, he's 2 years older than I am, and I had a younger sister, Mutsuko, she's here in Victoria, and one more born in Haney. Would be Hitoshi, or Toshi, he's in Vancouver right now, Richmond. And that was the four of us, four children. And that's where we stayed, I think, 37 to 41, when we had to move inland into the interior. 4 years old, so I don't really remember that much, but I do remember my dad delivering groceries from his small shop out to the neighborhood clients or customers. And I remember him saying, taking stock, adding, counting, no computers or not even an abacus. That was all on a piece of paper. And then once in a while, he'd be saying, gee, this guy hasn't paid up for quite a while, but everything was very friendly and neighborly, so he knew there was no problem in all his people paying up, and quite a few would delay over a month, 2 months, but that was the hardest time, I guess, and cash flow, you might say. But those are some of the times I remember riding out in the country in an old Fargo panel truck. We were fortunate because we had that vehicle, and it helped us out during the evacuation days, too.
Right.
But as to childhood, first 4 years over in Haney, I couldn't really remember too much the neighborhood if I go there right now. I still wish to go there someday and then really scan out the place and see what it's like. Yeah. I haven't been able to do that, but kind of looking forward to doing that someday. But Haney, I don't really recollect too many childhood, not too many memories that I could recall.
Yeah. Now, did your parents both immigrate from Japan itself?
Yes. My dad came over as a Yakuza student when he was about 17, I guess, early 1920s. And then he was attending school and then working. And then he used to work for a company, trading company called Furuya. And he got to be quite senior there, but then he wanted to start his own business. So that's when he got this small grocery store with a home attached to the that's like our corner store here, you see, now with the family living in the back or upstairs in the shop downstairs. And I guess guess my mother was pretty busy with just helping out and four kids.
Right. Did she come from the same area as your father?
My mother came from Tokyo. My dad came from Fukuoka, down to the south. And my mother was born in Korea, but she was over there because there were many Japanese working in the Korea, China, you know, those times. And I guess that's how things worked out. And they got married after, I think it was an arranged marriage, but my dad had to go back to Japan to get married. And then 2 months later, she came out. Yeah, that's the way things used to work, right?
Right, yeah. So do you have memories then of leaving from Haney?
That's from Haney to the interior. The place where we were moving to was a small, very small town, not even a town, one store, one gas pump type village, I suppose, along the North Shusha Lakeshore. And it's just to the north of Celesta. It's between Celesta and Anglemont. It's a very, very highly desired area right now. And that's where we first moved to, 1941. And we were fortunate in a way because my dad, as I mentioned, we had this Fargo panel truck. And there was a deadline some weekend, I recall, we all had to report to Hastings Park.
Right.
And we were able to depart Haney before that deadline. My dad packed as much as he could into the vehicle. Then he drove up by himself to Banga Bay, and he was met by Mr. Miyazaki. He was the maybe two or three Japanese Canadian living in that area at that time. So he welcomed my dad over there, and then he got things set up. And my mother and many kids, we left by train, leaving Vancouver. And then what I remember is the RCMP officers walking around as we were boarding. And then even it was quite late at night too, and after we were in the train, the blinds were pulled down, shutters on the windows. But outside I could see the RCMP high boots, you know, the boots. They were walking around outside. That's some of the things I recall. And then after departing, on the train departed, and then I remember the conductor saying, "Mission, mission, Mission City," and then can't even remember if the train stopped there, but I suppose it did, and then we continued on to Magna Bay, which was just really an overnight trip.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you remember your father telling you any stories about his reaction to the Pearl Harbor bombing, or his what he was thinking during those days?
Afterwards, I guess I don't really recall too much of what he had mentioned to us, but I remember they used to discuss at the supper table about the broadcast or the news of how the war was proceeding,
mm-hmm.
you know, and many, many lives are being lost on both sides.
Right.
And I remember he did mention, you know, sometimes I guess Japan will be losing this war because they don't have the resources, and that's exactly what my uncle used to say too. He was in Seattle, but they used to say the same thing, and people right now, if you read history, that's the way it turned out, right? So it's just things carried on, and the rest of the world had to, you know, bear the burden,
right.
suffer for all that.
Were there Japanese language newspapers or media in around the home when you were young?
I couldn't recall, but in Haney, too young to read or have that type of interest, but in the interior we prescribed to the new Canadian.
Right.
And that was the national paper. I guess it started out on the Westman National. And that was our paper for the longest time. And we used to read it just even up to, you know, just a few years ago, it seems.
Right.
Yeah.
So, when you moved to the Shuswap area, what are your memories of early life there? You were just a young man, I guess.
Yes, we were young, very young, and I remember the hardships my mother had to go through. But we moved into an old log house. It's a one-room log house way in the real bush area, and just so we went back there the odd times to see how far my mother actually had to walk to get down to the lake shore. And it's about 3/4 of a mile. It seemed like ages when we used to follow her down with her basket or bag load of laundry, you know, because there was no water in the log house where we lived with the old well. We had to dig and then obtain water that way. But it was pretty hard, and there are all kinds of bears and no electricity, of course. So we had the old coal oil lamp and no refrigeration whatsoever, so all foodstuff would spoil very, very quickly, and we had to dig a root house, you know, keep it a bit cooler.
Right.
But some of the foodstuff we used to have in the back porch, the bears used to get in there, and remember one pan was full of bacon grease, I think, and they liked that stuff, and they chewed through the pot with a real thin tin, you know, pot, and then there's a big hole in it, and that's where the bear tried to chomp through. Yeah, but it was really hard on my mother, I'm sure, looking after us and then doing all the heavy farm work.
Right.
My dad was working, commuting from this log house to a farm, really, a field, and he started growing strawberries there.
Okay.
And first a small patch, and then it eventually grew up to be 3 acres, and 3 acres was the maximum, I think. And that would be a few years after that, but in between, after about maybe a year and a half, we moved from that log house to another log house where our landlord, Mr. and Mrs. Noakes, really fine English homesteaders there. They had their proper house, and then they had this log cabin, so we moved into that. Again, one bedroom, and then we kind of built a lean-to so we could get the kitchen portion.
Right.
And that's where we were, most of us kids remember us starting up our childhood.
Right.
Yeah.
And was you would have had considerably more snow there in the winters than Vancouver. Do you remember?
Yes, it was lots of snow, and winter time we had the Shuswap Lake used to freeze, and again electricity. No, we didn't have any. We had one telephone line going through that whole village right up to Anglemont, and I remember winter time the lake. Ice thickness would be a good 18 inches, I guess, really thick. So we used to clear a patch and then skate on it, and then we used to skate, you know, quite a distance to the school to, and then skate back. But of course, when the ice started to melt and crack, we were told not to try it, you know. But ice blocks, we used to cut these. My dad had this great big guy, you know. Wood saw, what they call those, it's not one of those sweet saws, but you know, for cutting big logs.
Right.
That type, he used to cut big chunks out, and then that's a tough time, but it's kind of fun remembering. We used to haul the ice up somehow into a not very little shack we built, and that was the sawdust ice house.
Right.
We used to put layers of sawdust in between stacks of ice. And the ice would keep till about July, you know, and we used to use it for refrigeration purposes. Yeah, that's actually, my dad's pretty smart there, you know.
So it was kind of almost frontier style living where you really had to do a lot yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And would you have chores then as you got older around the house?
Yes, we all had our chores, and the main thing would be around the house. I guess we were attending school, so after we got back from school, we'd have some help with the cooking. And clean up, and we had a chicken farm there too, along with the strawberries. The chicken farm was right close to the house, the log house, and we'd be cleaning eggs all night, you know, after school. That was our chore, just get down, sit down along this, you know, from the lean-to to the main log house, just this one step. We'd sit on the step there, and then collect these eggs and then scrape off the dirt from the eggs, you know, clean them, and pack them in these fillers, 32.5 dozen per flap, right? And then scrape them, clean them, and then stack them up, and then about a week or so, we have a big case, wooden carton full of eggs, and if we have about three of those, there's a general store owner, Brown and Smith in Celesta. And they ran the branch store in Manga Bay also, and the gas pump. And they'd come and collect all these produce from the farmers, and then they'd ship them out to, I think, Lower Mainland and other areas requiring eggs.
Right. Yeah. So this was another means of getting some income for the family?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did you start to go to school then in that area?
Yes, we were housed in this one-room log house school. I think there went up to grade 8, but, you know, maybe one or two students per grade. Grade 8, I think there were two or three students.
Right.
And went to school there. Well, the teacher over there was our landlady, Mrs. Noakes. And she taught there for ages, and she was our next door neighbor, you know, just a few hundred yards away. And Mr. Noakes used to teach us music too, you know, the free time, weekends, or they were really musically inclined. And all their grown up kids, well, they were older than our kids, but they were really good musicians, you know, violin. Amy Bowman, saxophone, and anytime there's a Manga Bay type Christmas concert or function, it'd be the Noakes family providing the music.
Nice.
But Mrs. Noakes taught us throughout this time. We were there until 1948 because my brother Victor, he was in grade 8, and then school only went up to grade 8, so we had to moved to our next place, which was Salmon Arm, and that's where we brought up, you know.
Right. Before you did the move, was there, you mentioned there was a few Japanese-Canadian
yes.
families in the area?
Yes.
And did they have children?
No, they were all, seemed to be, I guess there'd be this Mr. Miyazaki who invited us over. He had a son, one son, and then his wife, and I can't remember the son's name, but they had two kids.
Right.
And I don't really know when Mr. Miyazaki Sr. Passed away, but he was sort of like the caretaker of all the people moving into Manga Bay area
right.
at that time. And he looked after all of us. But I could recall about two other Japanese families there at that time. And then all the rest followed us. Yeah, because we were first to move into this log house and then sort of get organized with strawberry farming and then chicken farm. and then quite a few Japanese families that followed us, possibly the same year or later on or the following years, they took on the same type of work. They had land. It must have been leasing land. I can't recall if they were paying rent or what, but it seems to be fairly cheap, I guess. So they were using their land, someone's land, and then growing strawberries. And then as a second line, they'd have their second house. And, we had up to 500 to 700 hens, laying hens. So
kind of a big operation then.
Yeah.
So in these days, did the small Japanese Canadian community there have any cultural gatherings or events that were going on?
Not as much as what we see here now, but every once in a while, I guess the families would get together. New Year's Oshogatsu, where we make some mochi upon the sweet rice, that sort of thing. Have a little get together, small group, but then we celebrate New Year's that way. And any mochi that's kind of fresh and ready to eat now, sort of things. Like my mother used to package them up and then you run this over to Nabata's. And we'd trot out. It must have been snow, it was New Year's first week of January. We'd go out there and then they firstly, made mochi for your dinner or, celebration. And funny thing, within half hour, 1 hour or so, their kids would come back with another gift, and return. I remember my mother saying, oh, I guess they do that because they're from Goshi, right? It's from Goshi, but I don't know where that is really. But they're all used to doing things like that in the old country, I guess. So, that's kind of funny, I thought. Just because they give them something doesn't mean they have to return it right away, Wait a week or so, taste it first.
So did you have Japanese language instruction?
No, there's no school as such over there, no teachers. But the only Japanese that we had by way of lessons would be by my mother. We used to keep a scribbler of daily diary, you might say, in Japanese, hiragana, katakana, and that was it. And some of these old diaries, I was kind of looking for them, but couldn't find them right now. And the three of us, like Victor, older one, myself, and Mutsuko, we were, pretty good in Japanese, and meaning we could converse to our parents, right? But as soon as we started school, of course, although we would try and still use it at home, but as far as writing, it was fast disappearing, except for hiragana, katakana. Kanji is very difficult, so we forget right away. I still remember a few kanji characters, but I won't be able to write a letter, But any siblings younger than Mutsuko, of course, we'd be at school, and then once we started school and playing with local kids, it'd be all English.
Right.
Yeah, so Japanese are gone.
Right. Yeah. Do you remember any hostilities during that time from the local people towards you as a Japanese Canadian?
No, I don't really say hostilities, but I guess maybe the kids were, we were just kids and we'd play around during recess or weekends, or there weren't that many close by neighbors anyway with kids. So if we did have friends, Canadian friends, they'd be a few miles, anywhere from half a mile to maybe 3 miles, and across the lake, sort of thing. So The only time we'd get together would be at the school,
right,
as children. And every once in a while it was normally boys against the girls, not really anything to do with race, the war, you know.
Right.
But at home, again, while cleaning eggs in Bangla Bay, I remember my parents, my dad, I guess, we had this shortwave radio. And he used to listen and then follow the war, how things were going, and how so many Americans would be killed, or Japanese warships being sunk and nothing, or else the other way around, Japanese forces sinking American ships, that sort of thing. And I do remember receiving news on the radio like that, and then we weren't, as kids, I don't think we were that interested. No, we were probably more interested in playing outside after the eggs were cleaned, or, you know, after supper, homework, that kind of thing. So, yeah. I don't really recall any expression by our parents towards our neighbors or the Canadians. They used to say, there was a term, I think, sort of a derogatory term, I would think, but you know, it wasn't used that often. But any time that he felt something wasn't quite right, you know, he'd come up with this term and say, "Kito-san" or something, you know,
like, you know, it's kind of a slur or something. Like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
Right.
But then probably the same thing about the local. Canadians saying, well, yeah, I do, now that you mention it, being called you yellow-faced Japs, you know. Yeah, that's right, that's right.
Yeah.
You Japs, you know. That was, I guess, at first very, very painful to hear, because we heard, and through our parents too, Jap, 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 you know, and, I guess it would be in the papers or
right,
news someplace, and that was really bad. So even now, if I see that term "Jap" written any place in the print, or someone mentioning it, I tend to correct them, because it's not that they don't know,
right?
Right?
They understand that.
So, yeah. And once they understand, then they, but they don't use that term just to you know, get onto us.
Right.
But it was pretty bad anytime. This word "Jap" was mentioned, you know,
right,
and then they followed by "you yellow-faced Jap," and then, I don't think we got into any scuffles, but,
right,
because they didn't know what was going on either. The kids, that is, or the adults, of course, would. But, yeah, but those are some of the tougher times, I guess. That sort of thing still carries on to this day, I suppose.
Right.
Of course, yeah.
Do you remember the hearing of the atomic bombings of Japan? Receiving that news?
I don't. Genchi Bakudan, atomic bomb, Genchi Bakudan. I guess the expression then, I remember, I guess my parents must have heard it on the radio too many times, but the initial shock, Pikatdon, the initial flash, followed by the shock waves. And these would be described in the papers, I guess. So, and they said something new dropped by the Americans, and really brought the war to an end. But was known as the atomic bomb, Genchi Bakudan, Genchi Baku, and that term "pika don," "pika" is the flash,
right,
bright flash, and then the "don" is the, you know, the explosion,
right,
flash, and the loud noise and the shockwave, I guess.
Right.
And I remember my dad talking about that, you know, and that's when he thought the war would be ending.
So it was shortly after the war that you moved down to Salmon Arm for high school?
Salmon Arm was 1948, last school year for my brother Victor. He was in grade 8, so from grade 9 he had to start in junior high, so we moved to Salmon Arm. And we my dad purchased a farm up in the Glen Eden Sanmerm area, in the upper hills, upper level. Yeah, 1948 and 1949 we started building the house. Again, we had a log house there. There was an old shack there, one room log house, so we all moved in there. And then we immediately built a second kitchen, you might say, another little lumber type shack where we stayed in the during the daylight hours, and then at night we moved back to the log house to sleep. And of course, you had to have the bathhouse, ofuro.
Right.
So there was a nice stream, creek flowing by our property, on our property next to the log house. So it was very handy getting water from the creek into this big tub.
Right.
And maybe a galvanized type steel tub. And then we'd have a fire built underneath. And then we get that going. That was some of our chores as kids to chop wood and make sure the furo or the vast water is hot for every night. Yeah, it's cold in the winter because it's not heated, right?
Right.
And then we'd have to go from the log house to the kitchen shack and then a few steps over to the bathhouse and then reverse. And then from the winter time when the snow was, you know, it used to get pretty deep. We'd be trudging through snow in our, I suppose, pajamas and a little bit of house coat, I suppose.
Yeah. So, is there a Japanese Canadian community in Salmon Arm?
Salmon Arm, yes. It was not, again, not large, but there used to be a get together and just get together during various. Annual functions, you know, or summer picnic or Christmas or New Year's. Yeah. Yeah.
And was there any more hostilities during this time in Salmon Arm?
No, I don't think so, because everyone, all the Japanese families would be fairly large families too.
Right.
And most would be concentrating on getting their kids through the school systems, I think. Yeah, because everyone that I know of, they all had good work, either running a farm or working at sawmill, logging, that sort of thing. Morning till night, weekends. Really worked hard. Yes. Yeah.
And do you have any memories of your high school experience that you'd like to share?
High school was rather... can't really... I know we all studied hard because our parents are always saying study, study, study sort of thing, but I hated the English reading, you know, but... no, I guess we got through okay. I remember for a number of... years, high school years, my dad used to go to the canoe sawmill. He used to leave the house around 6:30 in the morning. So, correction on that. He used to get up about 6 and then we'd make all kinds of noise in the kitchen around 6:30 and then we'd get up and then when he leaves for work around 7:15, we used to catch a ride into Salmon Arm, the town proper from only about 10 minutes by car, and we'd go to the school and do our homework there, and then take the school bus back home. But yeah, those were fast 3-4 years, I guess.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. 1954, when I was in grade 10, I remember my mother had her 7th child. George, he's at Salmon Arm right now. He's an optometrist right there. But he was a baby, and then 3 years after that, 1957, I left home for. So I must have graduated in 57.
Yeah.
Yeah. But high school days are okay. We went to the old J.L. Jackson Junior, it's not long gone because they have two more high schools there now, but that was our high school. My older brother Victor attended another high school, which was adjacent to this J.L. Jackson, which was old, smaller building, but that was the high school then. It was too small, so they built this new J.L. Jackson junior senior high.
Now, I guess high school kids can be notoriously cruel, but did you have any racist experiences from your peers in high school?
No, high school, I don't recall anything like that, because we had our own clubs, right? There were many organized clubs, sports, that sort of thing, and we enjoyed participating in as many things as possible. And of course, once you're involved like that, then you tend to work for that organization or try to make it a successful year for that graduating class or for that class year. Yeah.
So you had no problems then?
No, no. Just good memories in high school, good teachers.
Now, you mentioned in 1957 that you decided to leave Salmon Arm. Where did you go to?
School-wise, I went from Salmon Arm to right here in Victoria, Royal Oaks Military College. I actually followed the footsteps of my brother because 2 years earlier he applied and he was accepted. And then 2 years? No, he was in his senior year when I was in my junior year. Yeah, that's right. So I went there in 57, so I guess he went there in 56.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was that your main motivation for signing up with the armed forces then?
The main motivation was lack of money.
Right. Yeah.
And this was free, right?
Right.
Free education, so we thought, at least my brother thought so, and then our teachers in Salmon Arm High School thought so, so we followed that route, and then Victor said, it's a tough place, it's, I don't know if you should try it, you know, but I said, well, I'd like to give it a try, because
right.
Otherwise I'd be, was kind of hard working on the farm, continuing working on the farm, and income on the farm to pay for everything, at least by dad's maintenance bills and you know, that sort of thing. It's pretty difficult to see any savings.
Right.
So I thought just to help, I might follow Victor's footsteps there and continued on to Royal Roads. And when I was accepted, I was very happy. But it was hard.
Hard work.
Yeah.
What were your family and friends' reaction to your decision to join the armed forces?
Military? I think they didn't really see it as Victor and myself joining the military. It was just continuing the education program.
Right.
Because they didn't really know too much about the Canadian Navy or Army or Air Force at that time, and then I think it was really through our involvement at the college that they got to learn more about the three services, which was quite good.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, did you sign up then for the, did you choose the RCAF before you went enrolled in the
Yes,
Royal
Roads? I always wanted to be airborne and look at some of these contrails up in the sky,
right.
You know. Because you must have had jet planes in those days, 57, 58. I recall often in the garden, you know, looking up, and there goes another, probably a commercial airline with these contrails, and thought, gee, it sure would be nice to be up there, you know.
Right.
And always stuck there with me, and even now, I kind of miss flying in a way, but, you know. Or looking at old aircraft, I suppose.
Yeah. So, did you have to select a stream, a particular stream, when you went into Royal Roads, or was it kind of a general program?
The first year, I guess, before we went for summer training, so possibly around November, December area, we had to select or be selected for one of the three services. And I chose there, and I thought I'd like to get some flying training in summertime as a pilot. You know, everybody wants to be a pilot when you're young. And, I tried that, and I was selected as a pilot. So my first summer training over in Penhold was with flying squadron, training squadron for FTS in Penhold. And that was only for about, 3 months or so, because we had to have some holidays before we returned to classes. So,
right.
Yeah, and first year went okay, and back to our classes, Royal Roads. And then the second year at Royal Roads, we all had to, for some reason, study the engineering type courses.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with no lack of calculus and salmon arm, my math was really weak, and of course my English was terrible too, and that was these students from Ontario and I think Saskatchewan, they had really good math programs, I guess, because they had a bit in high school,
right.
And I guess BC curriculum's really good for right now, you know, 40 years later, 50 years later, but that's the way it should have been at the start, but we lacked it, so all the kids from BC were, you know, suffering in that math area. But second year, I was really getting stressed out with the studies, and then I thought, I think I wrote back to my mother and brother and saying, gee, this is tough, and I should listen to you, Victor. And I guess he did say it's tough. And, it's not just the courses, but the other extra stuff that you have to do.
Right.
And normally I would put in more study time just to get assignments done, but just didn't have that time because you're involved in all types of sports and polishing and parades and attending various functions and required lectures or anything that's happening we all had to attend. And that was okay. That part was okay, but you still have to have your studies, right? And if you're behind in your studies, boy, it's difficult. And stress is, I still remember those stressful days.
Right. Yeah. But you managed to make it through and pass your courses and do the full...
Well, the second year, actually, I did not, mm-hmm. You know, and they said, do you want to repeat? And I said, no, I think I'd take the other option of joining, going directly into the regular force. It's called a short service commission, 5 years. And I had my summer training started. So after second year, I think it was about April, May, the advisor at Royal Road said, okay, we'll switch you to the regular program from... regular forces training program from the Royal Roads Educational Program.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that and then continued with my pilot training. And then I guess I always had difficulty flying at Harvard.
Right.
Because my legs are too short.
Right.
I remember at the selection board. I remember one of the chaps asking, you really want to fly, don't you? Because your legs are half an inch too short. And I said, so? You know, what does that... He says, well, we have something called a backpack, which is a backpack parachute, instead of the one most people carry on their... as a seat pack.
Right.
So when you're going on board inside a cockpit, you're... dragging this huge seat pack with you,
right.
You know, and then kind of, and then you get in and sit on the seat pack, and then you can see everything up above. But since my legs are short, I had this backpack, which gave me about, 3 inches,
right?
you know, from tailbone right up to the back of the neck there, and had something to lean on, but it was still, you know, hard.
Awkward.
Yeah. So when I tried to put full rudder on, I'd have difficulty.
Right.
And when you're up in a trainer like the Harvard, doing the spins,
yeah,
you could go up to 7,000 feet and then, okay, let's do a spin, and then that ground comes up pretty fast, and you have to recover, you know, full rudder and opposite stick, you know,
right,
the yoke, and you recover that way. But I always used to take it up to 10,000 feet without 3,000 extra insurance, you know. And then two of my fellow cadets training there, one from Norway, one from England, they were pilot officers, they were cadets, just as I was, pilots, not pilot officers. And two of them got killed.
Oh, really?
You know, a freak accident.
Right.
One landed right on top of another, because in Penhope we had these parallel runways, and I guess he thought he was landing on the, say, the right-hand runway instead of the left. He came in, and there was another guy landing, and kind of crushed his canopy and killed him. Another one ground looped and kind of killed himself. Norwegian, young, really nice guys, you know. But because you eat together and stay in the same barrack and get to know each other really well, but they passed away. And then again, you know, should I continue? And maybe I had a chicken heart or something.
Right.
So that was another stressful area. So I thought, my instructor said, you know, you could cross-train to become a navigator, you know. So, but at that time, there was another classification called radio officer.
Right.
And, I was told if you do that, you'd be going to a maritime warfare type aircraft where there are many, many radio officers required to operate the sensors. So I said, okay, let's try that, and continue on with that type of training.
Mm-hmm.
Which was over in Winnipeg.
Okay.
Yeah, Air Navigation School in Winnipeg. And then after about another year of training there, then went to the operational training unit for maritime warfare aircraft, which was in Greenwood, Nova Scotia.
Right. So when you were in Winnipeg, were you working on the aircraft themselves up in the air, or was it all tactical?
No, training.
Yeah.
Both. Classroom plus flying, yeah.
And what kind of aircraft were you training
in? Training aircraft at that time was the Expeditor. It's a small two-engine, what would you call it? You don't really see any of those things around. And then with more advanced training, with longer flights,
mm-hmm,
we switched to the DC-3 or the Dakota aircraft. And they're still flying in some of these countries, still very, very, a real warhorse, I guess, the DC-3s. And after that, finishing there, we went to Summerside for the 3 months operational training unit, OTU. And that's where we switched to the real big operational aircraft.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you were doing your operational training then, was it on the Neptune?
First started out with the Lancaster bomber,
oh, okay,
really old thing and very noisy.
Right.
And that was for a few hours, just for the basics. And then the forces brought in the Neptune, B2V7 Lockheed Neptune,
okay,
two-engine, radio engine, job, which was quite an improvement over the Lancaster bombers.
Right.
And that was really comfortable, we thought, but still very noisy. And not range-wise, it wasn't that good compared to some of the, you know, Argus aircraft that followed years later. Endurance hours being airborne was considerably, vastly improved.
Right.
But Neptune aircraft, they were good,
right,
for training.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So during this period, then, were you? What was your official trade title? Radio officer, navigator.
RO, no, just radio officer. RO, yeah, yeah.
And then, did you get it back into the navigation sides of things?
We all had to radio, but more the sensor operations being becoming more high tech. Fewer radio officers were required, and more and more emphasis would be put on the navigation officer, navigators. So, and whole radio officer, navigator, pure radio officer or pure navigation classifications, they kind of got together, combined, and were classified as air navs or observers. Observers would be the non-commissioned officers that had another sensor operating work, and they were known as the observers. And navigators would be known as the ANAVs, air navigators.
So can you describe then what your duties would be, for example, on a patrol with the Neptune?
Well, Neptune's, the first squadron I went to after completing the operational training unit in Summerside, Prince Edward Island, went to Greenwood, Nova Scotia, and was assigned to 405 Squadron. And the Neptune aircraft were still flying, but they were soon to be phased out with the new Canadair Argus. CL-28, I guess, Canadian-made four-engine maritime warfare aircraft.
Right.
And 1959, I guess, they were brought in, the Argus.
Gotcha.
And we were the first to be converted onto that new aircraft. And as I recall, 59, remember, our crew was selected to go to England, St. Mogans, England, to show the locals, maritime nations over there at the get-together, the Argus aircraft.
Right. Because the Argus is Canadian.
Canadian,
design.
Right. Canadian design, and the British Air Force didn't quite have an updated maritime warfare aircraft.
Right.
So they were considering the Canadair Argus aircraft too,
right,
as were several other maritime countries.
Right.
But as it turned out, I think Canadians purchased about 30-odd aircraft, 33.
Right.
And as far as I know, we lost one in the accident in Puerto Rico exercise, night flying, and they went into the ocean there, all 18. Crew members,
right,
plus the odd passengers on board, technicians,
right,
they all perished. Yeah. But Argus aircraft flying in Greenwood, I was with 405 Squadron for about 6 years,
mm-hmm,
and got transferred. I was in the Maritimes for 15 years, so I thought I'd never get out of Nova Scotia,
right,
and Prince Edward Island, because it's you know, three squadrons over there, two in Greenwood and one in Summerside. So I went back to Summerside, came back to Greenwood, and then short stint in Halifax. And then after about, I think, 16 years, I finally went to Winnipeg at the Air Nav School to teach.
So during your time at in Greenwood and Somerset, then, when you were flying your patrols, what was the crew like? How big was the crew in there?
Crew would have a standard 18 people,
right?
It's 18 souls on board, and then three pilots, because pilots could interchange, because these hours of patrol would be quite long, anywhere from 18 to 20 hours. So, and for the radio officers, there were six of us, and four navigators, and of course, there's always someone training, so some extra souls would be on board.
Right.
But the standard would be 18, and made it being standard, you know, when you order galley rations, the kitchen staff comps it, lets it pack up for, make ready for 18, and if it was going to be decreased to a pilot trainer, maybe three or half a dozen pilots only, and they just have box lunches, but if it's going to be an extended trip out to England or the Azores or Bermuda or any place like that, Norway, then there'd be other passengers, so the galleys would have to arrange for, or the captain would have to arrange for extra meals.
Right.
And these would all be packed on board before the trip away.
Right.
But the standard would be 18 hours, 18 hour patrol by 18 crew members.
Right.
Yeah.
So would you have a shift then during that patrol, or would you
yes.
be on?
Okay. Yes, we'd change over at each station after every, depending on the type of sensor you're operating. If you're operating the radar system, just like watching a scope all the time, so every hour or so you'd change.
Right.
Whereas other areas, you could stay at a station for 2-3 hours.
Right.
Like the radio station, we used to sit there for about 3 hours. But depending on the condition and the type of crew you had, if you had a new person on board and like to get them out of there after 2 hours because it gets pretty noisy,
right?
Wearing headsets and you know, like that's something. So until you get really well trained, you know, try to avoid that long 3 hour rotation or 4 hour rotation.
So the personnel in your crew then would be constantly changing then, or did you generally have the same crew for most?
No, same people on a crew. So crews, there may be on a squadron of maybe six Argus aircraft, may have about 10 different crews.
Okay.
And I remember one, my crew was B4, and my captain said, B4 is not behind, you know, we always had to be first and everything sort of thing. And there's always these competitions and... training, you're always training, you know, every flight is a training flight, and then the operational exercises, they're fun. Trips away are hosted by Greenwood, and they're all pretty high-key stuff, and it's always a lot of fun, but a lot of flying and a lot of planning, so that's good.
So what kind of armaments did you have?
Armaments, we had the standard Mark 43, so that torpedoes, depth charges, practice depth charges, or BDCs, they're just probably about 18 inches long, little bomb, powder, I guess, 1 pound of, 1.2 pounds of TNT packed in there, and then training runs, we just say, okay, navigator would be calling, tactical navigation system. So we had the navigators, there were four, I mentioned for each crew, but the routine navigator would get the aircraft and crew out to the exercise area, just the routine navigation. And once in the area, then the tactical navigator would, TACNAV would take over and then be running the show.
Right.
You know, and then these PDCs, there's a snort sighted, snort being a snorkel of a Russian or Soviet submarine.
Right.
And just pretend and play games and then go into this smoke marker, and that's the snorkel we see. So
right.
We go in and do these depth bomb practices with these practice depth charges, which is really a light bomb. But sonobuoys, we have sonobuoys, these underwater detecting radio phones, I guess, which transmits all these small explosives and charges, and then anything that's in the area, the echo would reflect and come back. And the navigator would know the range to a certain target, you know, say. That's all fun games.
Right. Yeah. So what were the, who was charged with actually releasing these? Were they automatic buttons from the...
No, the tactical navigator was dropping charge now, and then he might push the red button, and then the charge would go.
Right.
Yeah, because the real thing, it'll still be the navigator, right. And the pilot will go wherever this tactical navigator will set the heading, and then so many yards to go, so many miles, but there's always a standard procedure, and if radar sights something on his scope, and could normally tell if it's a small target or fairly large, and the area. If it's a real operational flight on routine patrol, we did come across one just off the Azores, north of the Portuguese Island Islands there.
Mm-hmm.
A small target, and then we'd proceed, close in, and then at this time the pilot would say, okay, descending now, in case the Soviet submarine's using radar or some sensing device and sights us up high.
Right.
So we go way down low, about 500 feet, 1,000 to 500 above the surface, and then close in, and then radar would shut down. To terminate the emission,
yep.
Radiation, so in case the Soviets are, I see the Soviets, but could be an exercise,
right.
Submarine could detect us.
Right.
And then the navigator would say, would have on his plot the exact range and position from the initial few sweeps by the radar, and then just to make sure radar come up again, shy. Again, to see if that target is still there,
yeah.
And if it is, he'd shut down again or put it on standby, and then the navigator will take over and fly the aircraft to the target.
Right. Yeah. And did you say in the Azores you had a target that you?
Yeah,
were
we actually came across a Soviet nuclear submarine.
Huh. So and, what's the procedure then for that?
Oh, at that time we just actually dropped these signal charges,
yeah.
To ask them to surface,
right.
And they just show their mast, and then they go right back down again.
Right.
But at that time, I guess the Soviet vessels were not supposed to expose themselves like that at
right.
all. So we kind of figured it must have been, must have had some problems, and they had to surface.
Right.
But they weren't really up on the surface, it was just the mast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And would you just have visual contact with the
visual contact, take photos, and then report right away. Yeah. And then we'd start tracking them, see
right.
where the submarine is headed.
Right. Plot their course.
And yeah. Then yeah. And then after we had to go in, refuel, or stop. The next crew will be coming up to continue the tracking.
Right.
And if we didn't, then the American patrol aircraft would take over. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Were there any accidents during that period in Greenwood that you remember?
Not that I know of. It was only the one I mentioned about the accident in Puerto Rico. I was out at that time. Yeah, I saw the headlines in the Edmonton paper, I guess
right.
it was, yeah. 18 souls on board, all lost sort of thing, yeah. And I knew many of the people that died in that crash.
Right.
Yeah, and it's Puerto Rico is a funny place. Normally, when you fly at night, even if it's really dark out here, and you can see the horizon, because your eyes adapt and you can see the horizon, so pilot normally sees, you know, he's flying visually. And then down there you can't see the horizon. It's all black, so pilots really rely on their instruments. And somehow something happened and was said at that time that probably went too low, and then when he turned, he dipped his wings and kind of cartwheeled in.
Right.
Yeah, that was, it was believed it was that, but it's hard to say. Everything just lost. So.
So you would have been operational then in the early 60s during...
59 you went to England there, so I guess 50-something. I think late 58, yeah, 58 went to Halifax to take another course and then went to the squadron and then 59. As soon as we got to the squadron and then our crew was selected, I was assigned to a crew. And I was fortunate that our crew, not because of myself, but you know, because it was maybe our turn to go someplace that we had to go and show the artist. I should put them.
I can just cut this part out of the tape later. So.
When did you get to Comox?
1974.
Well, yeah, you really feel when I got here in 79. I
got here. Here 74 to 78 in Comox.
July.
'74. I got the cold box from 74 to 78. Yeah. You know, I tend to forget.
A digital biography or anything like that on the computer? No. Or a service record or anything like that? You could take a picture of?
Oh, I was looking in the, not a biography, I was looking in the junk room this morning and came across some of these, but This is what I was looking for, the big album, and I couldn't find it, but some of these. That's my on my mother and dad. That's my dad up in San Juan.
Right on.
This is a more recent one. That's the youngest one, George. He's not from Christine.
Right.
This is my dad when he was working for the Puruya company, and before he got the grocery store.
The dress
yeah. And that's his bride right there, the mom and young man. That's a different photo. That's for living. This is in Magna Bay.
Yeah.
That's Chuseok Lake right there along the lake shore.
Right. Yeah. Cool. Is this the strawberries?
Strawberries. Yeah. Strawberry patch goes way back up there. And that's the old packing shed.
Right. Yeah. Big family, eh?
How many were there then? That's Victor right there.
Six. And there's one more after that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, 1945 came as born.
Right.
And then after that came and then Bobby, I guess, he's from Calgary right now. Well, that's Victor. He was in the forces too.
Yeah.
In the telecommunications area, and stayed in the forces for about 6 years.
In the Air Force?
Yeah. Yeah. Even through RMC, and then graduated RMC, and then went to the Central Service 3 or 4 years up in the Glory
Service.
Yeah. State Credit. High school. Is
that right now?
This is from our old house looking down.
Right.
Whereas this is afterwards, when my dad built this pool.
Right.
Nothing like that right now, so all big trees.
Build up here.
Yeah. This is in Winnipeg, when I was in their navigation school.
Right.
Weekend that he came over to visit.
Right.
Must have been a Sunday afternoon or something.
He's styling car there behind you. Complete with the wings.
These all packed away because I used to have them on my wall one time, but with too much junk, my wife says. So. But I had a break in service.
Right.
I went back to school here in the University of Alberta.
All right.
And then went back to join the
training forces after that.
So.
What did you go to school for in the interim there? What were you taking?
Alberta?
Yeah.
I took chemistry.
Oh, okay.
And what's biochemistry?
Right.
I just went to go work in a brewery.
Okay. A noble aspiration.
But, you know, that's okay, I thought. But,
right.
I said, no, that's not the place to go.
Right. Got to get
and then I got back in, yeah.
Next your school, eh?
Now, this is my commissioning school here. 1958.
Yeah,
June 30th. Yeah, June 30th. Perks
signature.
Oh, yeah. But our retirement wallet size card, I guess, has this, and I use that to get on the ferry as senior. But no, these are about the only things I really have, because my last thing was with Defense Research Establishment,
right?
And was a liaison that single military, there's only one military per establishment. And I used to take the scientists up north.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Forces station alert. I guess the way I used to remember the ice shelf, the ice from the shore out into the water area, that's all breaking down, you know, on a floating way. Amazing.
Yeah.
All that warming up. So that's our three metros.
Mm-hmm. And you remember this, Dave?
Hi, yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
92. 92?
Oh, yeah. 92.
See, he brings these all nice and put it away, but I can shove it in the middle.
Your dad's filing cabinet. Didn't they come framed?
No.
Well, this thing here, frame. This is on the up north.
Yeah.
And this aircraft, Twin Otter, came from Comox to support the ice shelf and
school with skis on it.
And all, when I was leaving, he said, this will be my last year, guys. And he gave me a great 3 years with the
aircraft. That Twin Otter is a good aircraft, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. You just see a short strip there and see if they can spot me. All right, I don't have to.
Well, you know, when they first got the original Otter, when the airport bought them, and they had to take pictures of it in Uplands.
Oh, yeah.
On it. Yeah. And that just before the thing, and then they took us up and down and took the press up, and then they short take off, you know?
Yeah.
Then they had a flag there, and
yeah,
they set up, yeah.
3 years.
How many years?
Well, 33 years,
going on. You know?
Yeah. I think in my, the 2 years I returned to university, I didn't know that the forces could be able to sponsor it.
Right.
And I said, yeah, the service and all, that's enough. So I got out. And then after I got back in, she said, well, why didn't you get the horse to pay for it?
Yes.
Oh, but when I went into recruiting center here, I had the detachment over here. Of course, recruiting center, the detachment there. What year was this? 1999. Well, I went from Comox to recruiting center. I had 4 years missing. Yes. I went recruiting here, and then on 8th Street, the place burned down. And there's some other 600 blocks of gates. That was a good
time. It's unusual to see anybody with 33 years or 35 years in the forces.
Right.
The government all the time.
Right.
The forces. Because usually, forces, I don't know if they have this lately, but you have to be a certain rank by a certain age. And if you didn't get the promotion, you stayed at that rank, and you had to get out.
You know, in coma, when I was, before I got to the recruiting unit, when I was about to move, I remember the squadron commander calling me in and said, okay, we have offered to make you, we're going to promote you major. And I said, gee, that's nice, you know. And so I get to stay here. And yeah, I was being at coma after 4 years. Would you mind moving to Somerset TDI?
Spent enough time there by that time.
I said, to tell you the truth, if I was by myself, I'd jump at this man, you know.
Right.
And then I said, I'll have to take it over with my wife. I did. No way.
Yeah.
I said, well, that's a good chance for me to get promoted. Probably for maybe 2 years or 3 years. Just this way I could make tea, because if I, my wife puts it in a big pot, and then you get all that tea leaf and
you should have done it as gone over by yourself for 1 year and say, I quit.
But, it was pretty funny. Except, okay, that's helpful. So we had two young one was a baby born in coma, cookies.
Thanks.
Close your eyes and have a good quality time, right? Relieve stress and
It does.
A lot of times when you work too much or your mind's racing away and have to just
need to relax.
Relax and relieve that stress and I imagine, you know, when you're going through your projects or master's
there's plenty of stress involved.
Do
you have time after the interview to drive me down to Fairfield? Do you have time to drive me down to Fairfield after our interview today?
No problem.
No problem? Okay, cool. I just I have to work at 4 o'clock, so I want to make sure I can get her there. Yes, we can continue. When were we here? At the end of your career in Greenwood, I guess, or at the...
Were we just reaching Comox, or...?
Yeah, I think so. So where did you go after you left...
Greenwood, Atlantic. Yeah, my last session in Greenwood was with that training squadron. I was instructing there for... that was another 3-year, 4-year term.
Right.
And that was really... we really enjoyed it.
Were you instructing radio operations?
It'll be the operational crew. They're already, before they were assigned to operational squadron, they had to take this operational training unit again, which was really for the aircraft, Argus-based aircraft, or Greenwood Argus-based. All the procedures, techniques, what all the navigators, observers, tactical navigators have to do on a routine patrol and that type of training.
Right.
Yeah.
And this would this be in-flight training or
both?
Just,
both. The basis ground training and then flight training and come back down. But they weren't as training flights, so they were short, maybe 8-hour trips instead of the 18-hour patrols.
Right.
So it was quite a change, enjoyable change.
And were you doing both instructing and flying operationally at the same time?
Yes. Okay. Yes. You'd follow a course. There's intake, say, 2010 or something for that intake, maybe about 12 students. And you follow that. You stay with that crew, entire crew, until graduation 4 months later.
Right.
And they're supposed to be capable of taking control of the aircraft.
And then, when did you end up leaving Greenwood then?
Greenwood, after that, it was a stint in Winnipeg as another instructing course there, but when did I leave Greenwood? My memory is really good. So I'll have to look at some of those.
Later.
Yeah.
No big deal.
Yeah.
So you
probably might remember. Do you remember when we left Greenwood?
73.
We were all?
73?
No, we came to Comox in 74, but that was from Winnipeg, wasn't it?
73. Yeah. Because Lisa was born in 74 in Winnipeg.
Oh, that's very good.
Yeah. So, winter of 73.
You're always traveling in the wintertime, pushing snow in a small, small Toyota, yeah.
Yeah.
There's nothing but snow, I guess. You don't see anything else.
So, you moved to Winnipeg for a couple of years then? For a year?
Yes. Was it?
No, yeah, there was for a year.
Yeah. 1 year?
Supposedly 6 months, but I didn't want to move, but just before having
a baby. We weren't even supposed to go to Winnipeg, I guess. We were supposed to go to that's right.
So
that's
she was going
I remember well now.
And then, another winter, I guess. So then they said that we could move in December, so they left us before Christmas.
another December move.
Right? And were you doing the same type of instruction, instructing a crew in the maritime?
This was a post-graduation type thing, so it was advanced navigation type training, and won't be the basic navigation, so it was interesting. I was filling in for a instructor who was kind of delayed in staying there or getting there, so I kind of substituted and took his place for about 6 months, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
So would this be radar-based kind of technical stuff?
No, this would be pure navigation.
And then from that point, you moved directly to Comox?
Moved that, posted to Comox in 1974.
And what were your duties there?
That was, Comox was another operational squadron, just like in Greenwood and Summerside. So just be assigned to a flight to start with. And then I was with the flight for, I don't know, couple years, I guess, and then moved into there was another different section called the standards flight, which would be more like a staff type job.
Okay.
Because newer people, younger people would want to come in and then
go into aircrew,
start doing their flying jobs.
Right. And you were still operating the Argus?
Argus aircraft, yeah. And that's when first heard of Argus having to be replaced, because
right.
It was meeting its deadline there, life. So they're talking about the American P-3Cs, or the Orion aircraft, and still flying now.
So what was your duties on the staff appointment then?
Well, it's a standards flight, so it's just making sure that every crew is up to normal proficiency. And in case of flying to American bases or taking part in exercises, go there, train before taking part in exercise, and then during the exercises, flying with various crews to assess how they're doing, and then give them debriefing after that.
Would there be many crews that would fail in your assessment?
Crews wouldn't really fail as no more flights for you sort of thing, but recommended, suggested training. No particular crew member may be lacking or just enough, not enough training by that particular crew tactical coordinator. So he'd be briefed on things like that, various shortcomings, and then they'd be assessed later on again to get them up to a certain standard so that their operational proficiency would be rated as, you know, excellent or top, be able to fly anywhere.
Did you ever encounter anyone who questioned your authority, you think, because of your Japanese-Canadian origins or your ethnicity?
No, I don't think so. Not at all. You know, once we were assigned to a squadron, everyone was really assessed for their ability to occupy that seat. You know, so you had to make sure you are up in your training.
Yeah.
Make sure that all your crew members are up in training too. Because after after Greenwood, I guess, in Comox, I was assigned as a tactical coordinator, which is really tactical coordinator, which is really running the whole crew.
Right.
Captain, from the safety point of view of the aircraft, is the captain, right? That's the tackle or the coordinator. Has the team, the whole crew. Right? It's under his command. Well, flying. So that was pretty good, but takes a bit more planning and exercise or work, I suppose, pre-planning, but that's required.
Was there any real difference between working on the Atlantic coast and working on the Pacific in terms of conditions?
The Atlantic coast, weather-wise, it was more severe. So we had always quite a few alternate airports to divert to in case of
severe weather.
Often, yeah. Or hurricane in Bermuda, so divert to Boston or Norfolk, Virginia, or Jacksonville, Florida, that sort of thing. But West Coast, weather-wise, it was always pleasant. Really had the odd exercise off Hawaii too,
right.
And everyone used to look forward to spending time over there, because
right.
We'd fly so many hours, but then we'd get that time off to
yeah.
rest up, and then yeah, it'll only be about a week to 10 days anyway, all the exercises last.
Right.
Yeah, but once you take part in an exercise like that, then you have that experience
right.
Under your belt, so it's good. And following your, you know what to tell the newer crew members.
Did you see any subs or anything of note while you were
doing patrol? No, no. Mostly we'd be training under fisheries patrol.
Okay.
Yeah, and same with these schools. There was always sovereignty flights, you might say. And then from Comox, we'd go up north to take part in the sovereignty flights there, show our flag up north.
Were there instances where you did spot a ship that wasn't where it was supposed to, and you
spot the odd vessels within the 200 nautical mile line, but they were just reported.
Right.
But anything within the 12 mile coastal boundary line there, then we'd really have to take pictures and report
right.
it. And if they're fishing within that limit, then they're prosecuted.
Right.
We'd report it, and then it's up to Department of Fisheries be able to press charges or
right.
go after them.
Would you attempt to contact the ships?
Oh yes, but
right.
A lot of times you just can't
right.
contact them at all.
Be through just radio, trying to contact
radio, them? Yeah. Even on the emergency frequencies, you know, try to contact them and see what types are back.
So, did your role switch then in Comox while you were there? You were operational and then doing some training instruction as well.
Yeah, at a more senior level, you might say, with more responsibility. Mm-hmm. So Greenwood wouldn't be in standards, you know, because I was still junior. And then with more hours, more time, then they expect you to take over a crew and that sort of thing. Yeah.
And when was it that you left Comox?
Comox, 1978. I was asked if I wanted to take over a detachment and recruiting over here in Victoria. And Victoria, that was a small unit, a detachment of Vancouver's. And we were in the Western recruiting zone, which covered Edmonton at the headquarters, and then all of Alberta and all of BC pretty well, and some part of Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have zone commander looking after our requirements for how many people would be required from our zone,
yep.
how many university students entering the college systems or universities. And there's a quota passed out. We always used to beat Vancouver as far as military college entrance concerned, you know.
Yep.
With a good, high quality, highly skilled students, you might say.
Right. So high what quality. Would the range of tactics be for encouraging recruitment?
I guess the high school approaches that was the big thing for us. Encourage by getting our staff members out to high schools,
mm-hmm.
contact the high school principal and arrange some meeting times, you know, either in a big auditorium or else a small classroom with selected interested students. And we carry on this approach. I was there for 4 years, while I was there, you know, we carried these on. And I think it's really paid off because we had really highest number of students being selected from Victoria, Vancouver Island area.
And where did you go after your period of recruitment in Victoria?
And then I went to National Defense Headquarters.
Right. In Ottawa?
Ottawa.
What were you doing there?
I was with a directorate called Establishment Requirements, DER, Directorate of Establishment Requirements.
Right.
And I was sort of I didn't really like that job very much because there wasn't too much to do. There's plenty to do, but nothing very exciting because there would be so many thousands of established positions within the Canadian forces from East Coast to West Coast. And if a unit in Camp Shiloh or maybe the nowadays, say, some army-based unit or a naval unit, say we need 10 more positions here now, we're short of people. But the established numbers would be set, right? Maybe at that time it was around 75,000 or so, like coming down all the time.
Right.
So even if we want to strengthen, say, Halifax Naval Base, certain headquarters or ships, by one or two people in each unit, well, that amounts to quite a high number if you total them off. So to get these extra numbers over to Halifax, you have to decrease a similar number from somewhere else.
Right.
So, and it was very, very hard doing that.
Right.
So our job in Ottawa under the director would be to see how many people are retiring, so how many positions are going to open up. So where do we assign these new positions to? And each unit, say Halifax or even here, Victoria, or even the old recruiting unit I had in Victoria, is established for 10 people. So if I was short staff member, I'd request another position, but that position had to be traded off from somewhere else, right? And if it was authorized, then that position in Manitoba may disappear,
right?
But that unit for the new position is coming from would have a certain number, right? Established position.
Yep.
So that'll have to change, and then that's now changed right. To Victoria. So
trying to keep this balance of the manpower in the country.
Until the government says, no, you could now recruit up to 120,000 people. When I first joined, we had about 125,000, and it kept decreasing.
Right. So you're constantly clawing back jobs then, right?
Yeah. And that was, in a way, hard to reply to some of these same old people saying, but we need people, we need people. And it just can't be done.
Right.
Yeah.
So, where did you go after Ottawa?
Ottawa. From Ottawa, we came. Was supposed to be my retirement run back to Victoria with the Defense Research Establishment Pacific. And while I was there, supposed to be a 2-year job, and turned out to be 3 or 4.
I
think it was 4 years extension. Because, again, it was hard for someone to come in and take my place, and then finally another officer came in, so it was okay. But that's where I retired after 4 years over at Gretchen back in 93.
Right. And what were you, what was your specific role?
I was a military liaison officer, so as a military liaison, anything that the scientists would require from the military, I would have to liaise with Ottawa directly or some operational squadron in Ontario or elsewhere to arrange this up to a year in advance. For example, those ice shelf exercises, some of those logistics supports, the Hercules aircraft, we had to book them about a year ahead, could 10 months to a year ahead for next year's, next winter's request.
Right.
and they say it can't be done. We just don't have the airtime for these aircraft. That's not impossible. So take it back to the scientists over here, and they said, but we have to have it for the exercise of the, and since there was always a joint exercise with the Americans, our thing with the scientists took priority over any other thing. So, so we got the aircraft and made the Hercules airlift to the Arctic, maybe one or two trips a week, weekly. Week and then at the start of the exercise, always end of March, pitch black up here at that time. So many flights coming in with supplies. And then the first 2 weeks of May, when the ice is beginning to get soft, everybody will be off right now because it's too soft. And this year was warm too, so I think it was towards the last week of April, everybody had to clear off.
So what was the nature of the research that they were doing up there in the Arctic?
Well, I guess it was always trying to, early days was to detect the transiting Soviet submarines, and also in our case, see if we could spot the American nuclear subs too. They were both up there, we knew that, and the Soviet Navy knew that the Americans were up there too, but they were playing games up there. And our job was to, for the scientists, to lay a, there's a big ledge just off by Ellesmere and Lomonosov,
first ledge.
They're still working it out right now. They were just out there until a couple weeks ago, continuing. Of the, there's an Alpha Ridge, it's called that. The scientist out there this year was dropping charges and seismic echo sounding to try and prove that this ridge belongs to Canada,
right.
Because it's a continuation of the northern tip of Ellesmere Island.
Right.
But before this, when I was there in the 90s, we were trying to lay out string of what would you call it? Not sonobuoys, but detection, detecting sensors all along the ledge.
Right.
Okay, but yeah, the thing that's all covered in ice, right?
Right.
The idea was to punch a hole close to shore and then load this submersible vehicle with cables.
Yeah.
And then get the cable out here, and then recover that submersible back into that same.
Right.
Okay. And when I first started out there, we were digging big holes and then trying out these vehicles for the first time. And when I left there, the vehicle was just about ready.
Right.
The cables and everything would be ready, and the sensors would be ready to be deployed. But I don't know what happened after that. It's a long process. The trip had to disband shortly after all that.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, back of funding, and all the scientists had to scatter to other defense research establishments.
So,
that was a very enjoyable time.
Right? In the Arctic?
Yeah. Up in the Arctic and working with the defense scientists.
Yeah. And then you ended up retiring from the defense research
establishment. Yeah.
And do you do any other projects other than this this work up in the Arctic with the
mainly my job was with supporting the Arctic research with the defense scientists. Yes, there were other areas, other section of the lab worked on, like on the West Coast with the University of Victoria. I think that's still ongoing too. Tremendous cost.
And then what year did you retire?
1993. Okay. 1993. April, I think it was. Yeah.
So, is there anything that that you think we've missed for your career? Any stories you'd like to share? Or just any notes you'd like to say about your military career?
Military career? I have no... Well, it was all went by so very quickly, you know, 33 years. I always think of 35, but 33 full years, so I'm now on pension. It's not like what young people get pension-wise, but it's still nice to reflect back on some of the things we went through. I know that many of my buddies from my flying days have now passed on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's unfortunate, but pretty young people, you know, one of cancer cases, and some from liver disease or else accidents.
Yeah,
just off my own crew of 18, I think about, I was counting maybe a couple of years ago, but I think about seven or so that I know of, which is pretty sad to see.
Yeah.
That's why I'd like to sort of keep working and keep my brains going active and you know,
so
exercise and stay young. Yeah. At least try to keep the mind young anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, you're a marathon runner.
Yes. Yes. I started by 98, I think it was 1998.
Yeah.
I saw this Olympic runner come to UVic. I had my cutout still posted on my board back there someplace, but I attended the UVic McKinnon gym, and she said, no, what you do is start out with a short run,
right,
and try it.
Right.
And then I thought, yeah. And then about the same time I saw on TV this documentary on why people in Sweden live so long.
Right.
And there was this 93-year-old. And he looked really, really healthy.
Fit. Yeah.
Fit. And showed us what he goes through each day, what he eats. And,
right. His regimen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you've persisted.
And I said, well, he could... he could live to be 93 and look that way, and right. I'm only 60, at that time I was 60, I'm 71 now, so it was 58, and then about 60 is when, you know, I really got into running, because 98, and after that I was doing a little bit of short runs,
right.
And I thought maybe I'd try the marathon, and right. Then kept working at it, and yeah, so.
That's good.
Yeah, it keeps me going, and you feel good.
What marathons have you done?
I've done Victoria several times. And the most recent one was in last Sunday, 4th of May, a couple weeks ago, in Vancouver. It was a full marathon. I enjoyed that. And I've done Victoria, Vancouver, Seattle, Hawaii, Boston, and then last year I did Rome.
Yep, nice.
I don't know, I have a box full of these finisher things here, but must be close to 30 marathons now.
Pretty active then.
Yes. Yeah, but it's good, Will. You could do it too.
Yeah.
It's a real good, really good way to relieve stress.
Right. Yeah.
And get rid of all that, what?
Tension? Yeah. Fat?
You tend to get skinny, you know, when you're running all the time. But antioxidants.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great for you.
No, eat properly and then exercise and then you burn it off and sleep well, eat well, and then I hope live to be 93 like this Swedish gentleman there.
Right on.
Yeah. But I enjoy it because it's my quality time. Mm-hmm. Running and a lot of people wear headsets, but I just look at the various sceneries,
right.
Different type of homes, and you don't have to take the same route all the time,
right.
Except in the race itself.
Enjoy the scenery.
Yep. So last week I booked myself for the London Marathon,
right.
And I booked my flight,
great.
Air Canada, so I just keep running and then try not to get injured and then go there with, I hope Cody goes, actually. You could go by yourself. But no, she enjoyed this.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Good luck in the marathon.
Yeah, thank you.
But I think we should probably call that an interview. I have to run out of here. So.
Sure. Thanks very much
thanks
for coming.
Thanks for the interview. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was good.
Lots of luck.
Stuff on there. Yeah, and I just need...